Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 27th of June. Egypt's presidential elections this hour of the program. They have been called a watershed moment for the country, an unfinished revolution, and political Islam. How fair were the elections? What about yesterday's Egyptian court tossing out a government decree allowing the army to arrest civilians? Some analysts have said that the Islamists and the generals are in for a long power struggle. Who is the new president of Egypt? What do we know about him? What do we know about the Muslim Brotherhood? And what do we know about U.S.-Egyptian relations and Egypt's relations with Israel and with other countries in the Middle East? We have a lot to talk about this hour, and we have two superb guests. Joshua Stacher is assistant professor of political science at Kent State University, the author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. He has done commentary for NPR, CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, Foreign Affairs, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe, and is also a founding member of the Northeast Ohio Consortium on Middle East Studies. He will be a fellow, actually he is, it's 2012, a fellow this year at the Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars. And Professor Stacher, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Also joining us today is Mona El Ghobashi. She, Professor Ghobashi, is on the faculty at Barnard, where she is assistant professor in political science. Her dissertation was on institutional change in authoritarian regimes, and her interests include social movements and democratization in the Middle East and also in North Africa. She has, just in the last couple days, returned from Cairo, where she was observing the elections. And Professor Ghobashi, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the presidential election in terms of how large a moment it is in the country. Would you describe it as a watershed moment? And if so, what would that mean? If not, why wouldn't you describe it that way? Professor Stacher?
Well, I think that the presidential election could have been a much bigger moment had the Supreme Constitutional Court not come out and dissolved the parliament. As well as, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, come out and unilaterally a constitutional declaration that emasculated a lot of the president's powers. So in a lot of ways, SCAF robbed the election of its real legitimating or real power had they just allowed the election to go unfettered.
Professor El Ghobashi?
I agree with Josh. I think it's a watershed moment in the sense that this is the first time that Egyptians went to the polls in relatively free elections. The irregularities and rigging of the past were largely absent from this month's election. But at the same time, as Professor Stacher just pointed out, the election is kind of a Pyrrhic victory in the sense that Egyptians did indeed elect a president, but his authorities and powers are severely circumscribed by the something like 19 generals who currently hold all executive power in Egypt, and with the dissolution of the parliament, they also hold all legislative power, including the power of the budget.
How do they have all that power? What's in the structure of Egyptian government that allows them to have all that power?
Is that directed at me?
Either one.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, They don't necessarily have that power. They've taken it since President Hosni Mubarak was forcibly deposed on February 11th. In many respects, they have, carved out a place for themselves, constitutionally, and have done a number of bait and switches with the, population to design their sort of authority and really become a Pakistan-esque fourth estate. In the country, at least that's what they're trying to do. Of course, this is being resisted by the architects of the revolution.
Mm-hmm. And what can they do to effect change, the architects of the revolution, Professor El Ghobashi?
Well, what they've been doing for the past 16 months is they've been using the only power that they really have, which is the power of the street. During crucial moments of the past 16 months, millions of people have filled the streets in Tahrir Square, but also in all the squares of the rest of the country. And they've been able to extract significant concessions from the ruling general simply by going to the streets and camping out. One of the most significant concessions they got was the timing of the elections that we've just witnessed. The generals had indicated that they wouldn't leave power before 2013. And after a series of quite bloody clashes with the military on the streets of Cairo and other cities in November, the military backtracked and set the date of June for the presidential elections and the ultimate handover of power. Looking forward, I think the revolutionary forces will continue to use the power of the street. But one of the most interesting things that we should be watching is how the newly elected president will try to reach out to these new forces, knowing that part of the reason that he's in office was due to 7 million votes of people who do not support his organization or his Islamist politics, but they went out to vote for him to make sure that the old regime candidate would lose, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a good time to find out more about him. We also like to know a lot about people who are running various countries in the world. Let's get some more background information on Mohamed Morsi, where he was educated, how he happened to win the election, and, of course, the question that everybody's wondering about is what it means for him to be the country's first Islamist president and how his background may guide how he will lead. Professor Sacker?
Yeah, well, I've had the opportunity to know President-elect Morsi fairly well. I was with him in his parliamentary district in Zatzig in Sharia government in 2005 when he was essentially robbed of his election, of his parliamentary seat there. And I've interviewed him pretty much every year since, and I go to Egypt for research. And, you know, he's very soft-spoken. He has sort of a sort of sharper edge than many of the people that sit at the head of the Muslim Brotherhood organization. He's not a sort of natural politician in that sense. There's been a lot of writing about President-elect Morsi in the press, describing him as sort of, you know, anti-American or having questionable views on sort of, you know, 9/11 or these sorts of things. But I think these are sort of sideshows. You know, I really don't know how much President Morsi's personality is going to really affect his administration. You know, he is on the sort of powerful Maktabat Irshad or guidance office inside the Muslim Brotherhood, which is sort of the sort of collective body at the top of the organization. And there's also been some talk that, you know, maybe, you know, he's not on that group that may belong to Khairat al-Shah. Essentially, from the research that I've been able to do on them, but I've never understood the Muslim Brotherhood as this type of organization. No one person on the Guidance Council can assert their authority on anybody else. It really is a collective body, and in this sense, you know, it kind of takes the personality out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, you know, I don't think that, I don't think that Morsi's personality is going to really dominate the presidency. And, of course, there's this sort of, you know, the monster hiding in the closet, which is Supreme Court, and what they're going to allow him to do and what they're not going to allow him to do. And that will also greatly affect his
Professor El-Ghorbashi, your thoughts about who he is.
I agree with Professor Sacker. Mohamed Morsi, before he now is an international figure, he was a rank-and-file politician in one of Egypt's oldest political parties, the Society of the Muslim Brothers. He never really was one of the front-running leaders of the organization. He doesn't have that much charisma. He wasn't really well known even to the rest of the Egyptian population because there were more prominent leaders at the front of the organization, more prominent because of their leadership skills or because of their finances. They bankrolled the organization. But now that he's thrust into the most powerful position in the Middle East, we're going to start to see a lot of new features. He may, like many leaders, grow into the role. He may surprise us all and start to exert some more dominating features than we've seen so far. But again, just to underscore what Professor Sacker has just said, his position, even if he was the most charismatic politician in the world, is severely circumscribed by a much larger force, that is the generals, who, of course, are also supported by the U.S. government. And
mm-hmm.
so he doesn't have that much he can do.
How did he happen to be thrust into the position he is if he was not somebody who you would expect would be thrust into that position?
He's actually an accidental candidate, as many have said. He became the candidate of the Muslim Brothers because their original candidate, who is the real strongman of the organization, a businessman, billionaire businessman by the name of Khairat al-Shatir, he was disqualified by the election commission on technical grounds having to do with his background and criminal convictions, having served prison time under Mubarak's jails. So on that technicality, they excluded the real strongman of the organization, and so the party, knowing that their man would be disqualified, then fronted Mohamed Morsi as the candidate.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, what about the role, Professor Sekar, of the courts? Yesterday, an Egyptian court tossed out the government decree allowing the army to arrest civilians. What kind of authority does the courts have, and how do they play? It's sort of hard to understand who's got the power here. They obviously have quite a bit of authority as well.
Absolutely. This is probably a question that's better suited for Professor El-Ghobashi, but I mean, I think that, you know, the courts are a real source of political contestation right now in Egypt. There have been a lot of people that are questioning the sort of autonomy and independence of the Supreme Constitutional Court, which is the one that was fingered in these sort of very dubious rulings on the eve of the presidential election on June 14th. But, you know, that said, I mean, the ruling that you're talking about yesterday came from an administrative court, and in there, in fact, we see that there is a great more deal of autonomy. And the ruling that they actually said is on the 13th of June, SCAF instigated a law that essentially puts emergency law or martial law back on the country, which had been allowed to expire in late May. And what this court did is come out and said that the military does not have the arbitrary right just to arrest people. While this is definitely a victory, I think we have to be a little bit sort of, vigilant in our watching this situation, because in the Constitutional Declaration, there is a provision that allows the Supreme Council to authorize the use of force and repression when it seems fit to kind of help save the country. And it's worded so ambiguously that it could be, potential abuse. So this was definitely ridding one of these redundant clauses. But, it's obviously a battle that's going to play out and continue to play out in the months ahead.
And is there an appeal process in that court decision or not?
There is an appeals process. The government can appeal before a higher Supreme Administrative Court, and the higher Supreme Administrative Court historically has often handed down rulings that were generally friendly to the executive authorities and to the government. But just to expand on the role of the judiciary in Egypt is one of the few places, like the streets, where people could actually go to contest government power, even under the dictatorship of Mubarak. Now, the courts sometimes ordered or issued rulings that were highly friendly to civil liberties and to citizen rights. The problem wasn't that these rulings were not able to come out. The problem, of course, was that they were almost impossible to implement. You can have, and Egypt does have, many independent judges in addition to many judges who are in the pocket of the regime. But the independent judges, no matter how many rulings they issue, they're constrained by the capacity of the executive to actually implement their rulings. So they can issue a lot of wonderful rulings. The problem is that they don't have power to implement those.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's my understanding that the parliament was dissolved. I don't know how you can run a country without a parliament if you have a democracy. How are they going to reinstate a parliament? And who would do that? And is that okay with the generals and with the new president?
I mean, this is a question that's very still much in the air. I mean, they will have to have parliamentary elections sometime, too. When I was speaking with the Muslim Brotherhood last week in Manafaya government, where I watched the elections, they essentially told me that they were expecting these to happen in 2 or 3 months, which seemed like a bit fast for the timetable. I think that, you know, what we're really looking at here with SCAF is, they keep trying to change the goalposts a bit as a way to kind of entrench themselves and ingrain themselves deeper into the Egyptian political system, because
The only thing that really helps with that is time. And of course, you know, it's unclear exactly where the parliament, when the parliament will be renewed. I mean, obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood, we can expect them to run widely in this election. So, you know, I don't really see how the military is going to sort of, you know, outmaneuver the Brotherhood on this sense. It seems like the more elections you have, the worse it is for the Supreme Council, or for the military.
Mm-hmm. Professor Ogabashi?
In the new constitutional declaration that was issued by the military generals after polls closed on June 17th, it stipulated that new parliamentary elections would be called only after a constitution had been written. Now, that may seem logical. First, you need a constitution to lay out the powers of parliament and the presidency, and then you can run new elections on new rules. The big problem with that, of course, is that what this means is that the new constitution is going to be written not just under the auspices of the military, but the military also gave itself veto power over the constitution writing process.
Oh my.
So they basically get to control what goes into the constitution, and we all know, of course, that all militaries, like all unelected institutions, want to write in their powers into the constitution. So even if parliamentary elections are called after a constitution is written, my guess is that they're going to be much more subscribed under rules that will be highly favorable to the generals. But I agree with Professor Stacker, no matter what, I think the Muslim Brothers will also show very strongly during the election. So their main strategy is indeed delay, delay as much as possible.
So considering all of this, do you think that there will be any substantive change between the Mubarak regime and the, I don't know what to call it, it's kind of a Morsi
military
regime? Yeah, will there be any substantial difference?
I mean, look, it depends how you want to sort of measure change and continuity. If you're very interested in sort of, you know, spectacles and events and, like, new modes of contestation and new modes of political learning, then, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of change. I mean, many of the streets of Egypt, not just Cairo, are filled with wonderful, you know, artistic expressions of resistance, and, you know, the protest slogans are creative, and there's a lot of political learning going on. So in that sense, there's been a ton of change. And, you know, let's not forget that, you know, Hosni Mubarak may not be in prison, but he's in some sort of incarceration. He does not have freedom of movement. And the Muslim Brotherhood is now in his former office, which is, you know, a tremendous amount of change. However, that said, if you're interested in sort of, you know, lines of sort of hegemonic power or the ability for political elites to manipulate and maneuver around various social forces and play one off the other, then there's been a lot less change. There's been more continuity in this sense. And, you know, in many respects, ever since the fall of Mubarak, and I'm of the view that they experienced a leadership change rather than a regime change. I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, Egypt has gotten far more repressive than under the Mubarak regime in terms of having the repressive coercive apparatus interacting with segments and groups of the population that it previously had not. Increases on attacks on women and harassment of women is up. You know, there's been sectarian incidents that have escalated. And while all these things were present under Mubarak, I mean, it's expanded in ways that, haven't been favorable for sort of more inclusive change.
Hmm. Well, Professor Ogabashi, that's not going to make people in Egypt very happy.
No, it's not. I mean, the elections really were kind of a downer for many people, especially given the early promises and hope of the revolution in its early days, when people thought that if the Egyptians could overthrow a dictatorial system that lasted for 30 years, then there was so much emancipatory potential for really changing these structures of power. Now, 16 months later, we have a much more jaded view of the possibilities of change. I agree there that it looks at this juncture to be more of a leadership change than an actual fundamental change in the way politics gets done. I would add, though, that we are in a very fluid transitional situation in which there's a power struggle between the two main players, the Muslim Brothers organization and the military, and also, to a lesser extent, the third junior partner in the Egyptian arena, which, of course, is the Revolutionary Forces. They don't have as much power as the two big players, but they're also not insignificant. They're not negligible. They have veto power. They can go out on the streets and at least thwart the strategies of the other two big players. Ultimately, what this might look like, we don't know, but I think that I would bet that the way Egypt would look in the next 3 to 5 years is significantly different in the sense that you no longer have strongman or single man rule. You have something that looks much more of a triad between the military, the Muslim Brothers, and the dispersed and fragmented but still significant revolutionary forces.
Yeah, but can you do anything? Can you get anything done if you have people who are that different from each other?
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It's going to be complicated, because, you know, there's also, I mean, I would agree completely with Professor El-Ghobashi's assessment. I mean, it's spot on. I guess the one thing that I'm kind of looking at and the way I'm seeing it is that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood tends to look, it's a much more efficient, but it tends to look a lot like the state apparatus in terms of hierarchies and social class issues. Whatever problems you find in the state apparatus, you tend to also find in the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, we've heard lots of reports of contestation from below and how they make decisions in an autocratic way. And so, you know, in one respect, while the Muslim Brotherhood can potentially use the very, you know, powerful street veto, in one respect, I mean, it's sort of a half-hearted commitment because they're much more naturally inclined to sort of work with the organization of state, which tends to resemble them. And the Muslim Brotherhood is pretty adverse to popular mobilization. Mm. So I think that, you know, we are watching these two big behemoth political forces kind of, you know, interact with one another and create a sort of ruling pact on sort of who gets what. But, you know, it's not even that the Muslim Brotherhood and the military are sort of active or equal sort of partners. The military is far more entrenched in the economy, with a lot of transnational and sort of foreign support, whether it comes from the Gulf or the United States. You know, the military has all the weapons. So, you know, in many respects, you know, they've taken a lot of that executive power with them as they're going to exit stage left here on June 30th when President-elect Morsi becomes president and assumes the office. So, you know, in that sense, you know, it's a very complicated picture at the top, and it's not equal third parts at the top. But, you know, that said, I mean, it is entirely fluid, as Professor El-Ghobashi said, and we don't really know, you know, how things are going to play out.
Mm-hmm. We're going to start taking phone calls for our guests. We're talking about all that's going on in Egypt, the future of the country, and how power is solidified, what happens to the parliament, who the new president is, what about the control of the military. I'm wondering if the United States will reexamine its support for the military as a result of this election of the first ever democratically elected president in the country, Mohamed Morsi. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And Facebook, if you'd like to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are Professor Mona El-Ghobashi, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science at Barnard College, and Professor Joshua Stacker, Assistant Professor of Politics, Political Science at Kent State University, author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Both our guests travel frequently to Egypt and were in the country during the time of the presidential elections and subsequent to that. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Fascinating program yet again. I'm really enjoying this, but it does raise a couple questions for me. First of all, pretty easy one, how long is the term of the president? But more important, or more of interest, I think, to me, is I am not used to a system where you have a parliament and a president. My understanding is, you know, like Britain, they've got a parliament, they've got a prime minister. And I know there are other countries where they have a president, but the president's more like a figurehead who goes to funerals and represents the state but isn't really a political entity. So I guess I just wonder, how is this thing supposed to work? Who's supposed to legislate? What is the president's role? Is the president one like we do, we have, in terms of supposedly enforcing the laws? How do they all relate?
Professor Ogabashi, you want to start?
Sure. The term of the president, and this, of course, is after the revolution, the term of the president is now 4 years, which is, of course, a huge victory. If you think about it, before that, Egyptian presidents had essentially no term limits, and they codified that into the old constitutions. Scott's question is a really good one. How do you make this system work? It's supposed to work as follows. It looks very much like the American system in the sense that the president is the chief executive officer. He has extraordinary power to implement policies, to propose policies, to try to run them through the parliament. He has the power to appoint all cabinet ministers, including the prime minister. So it's not like the parliamentary model in Britain, where real power resides in the prime minister, who comes from parliament. It's very much like a presidential system. The problem now, of course, is that even though it's supposed to work that way, we know that there's a fourth estate over this system, that is the ruling generals, who want to not only take the power of the legislature, but they also want to take the power of the president and make him essentially, like Scott says, something like a figurehead. He can cut the red ribbon, he can show up on TV, but essentially his hands are tied.
Do you want to add anything to that, Professor Stecker?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing is this. I mean, it seems like, you know, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is also a bit nefarious in the sense that it wants to kind of carve out some of the legislative abilities as well as the executive abilities. It wants to sort of be able to put pressure on sort of, state-sympathizing or old state-sympathizing judges. But, you know, it's very into this sort of spectacle of elections and representation, because in a sense it's almost trying to become king-like or monarchical, in a sense that it wants to be above the fray of accountability while it can kind of play off these sort of institutions against one another, and at the same time, you know, have a place to shift blame for when there are problems while maintaining all the sort of national security portfolios. So this is a real power grab, or an attempted power grab. I mean, you know, the story is not yet written, and we will see what happens. But, yeah, that's the only thing I would like to add.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. Since we do now know that this is supposedly going to be a four-year term for this president, and my understanding is that one of the things the revolutionary forces, the Tahrir Square pro-democracy group, came to realize was that they had fragmented their vote by having so many candidates from their ranks, and that this is what probably cost them to be in the final election. Do you folks get the sense that they've learned from this and that they will be able to pull themselves together and, you know, come up with one candidate the next time around, if there is a next time around?
I think that's really the question of the hour. Everybody's now watching what the forces of Tahrir Square, for lack of a better term, are going to do. There are a couple of options on the table right now. For instance, one of the presidential candidates who was seen as a representative of the revolution, he's now trying to rally these forces around him for him to now serve as an opposition figure and set the stage for running in the elections in the next 4 years. I should also add that though the president's constitutional term is 4 years, renewable once, many, many people are saying that because the situation is so unstable, we wouldn't be surprised that he wouldn't be able to finish out his term. And if the constitution is written and new parliamentary elections are held, we may indeed see new presidential elections even before these 4 years are up.
Mm-hmm. Oh my.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing also. You know, we've now had 5 electoral days of voting in Egypt since March of 2011. And basically the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces have emptied or hollowed out these meetings, whether we're talking about the constitutional referendum in March of 2011, the parliamentary elections of, you know, November, December 2011,
There's good reason for this skepticism that, you know, the military will, you know, trigger some sort of legal booby trap that invalidates the Morsi's term in office, and that it won't really mature into a 4-year term. So, all options are on the table in that sense, and I think people are preparing for that in ways that I don't think they were preparing for, you know, the potential dissolution of parliament or, you know, constitutional declaration.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott, for your call, as always. What about the relationship of the United States with the military? Both of you have talked about the fact that we have supported the military, certainly in the past, and that we are doing that now. Does this election force us to reexamine our support for the military in that country? Professor Stacker?
I think that there is going to be a tremendous amount of discursive rhetorical sort of questioning. I mean, it's already started. I mean, there's already been these op-eds talking about who lost Egypt, and the State Department has come out and is, talking about how they respect the presidency of Morsi. The Obama White House is also on board with working with the Morsi presidency. Other people that are close to the administration are claiming that, you know, American sort of intervention quietly with the military, after the election happened, but before the official announcement occurred, was, you know, attributed somehow to the Americans, basically saying they had to respect the election, the votes. This all looks very good, and it's high drama. It is theater of a spectacular order. However, if you look at the sort of subtext, since January 28th, which is when the security forces were defeated on the streets of Cairo and many other cities across Egypt, the Pentagon has had an increasingly large role in managing Egypt policy. And it's really been Pentagon to sort of SCAF diplomatic communication that I tend to kind of look at as more telling than anything coming out of the State Department or in some respects even the White House at this point, particularly out of the National Security Council. So, I mean, there's been a real militarization of U.S. foreign policy towards Egypt, as Egypt has witnessed expanding sort of militarization into domestic politics. And I don't get a sense in my informal dealings, giving talks in Washington, D.C., or having the opportunity to meet with policymakers, that they've ever really considered this idea that they're going to let Egypt go on its own and sort of be autonomous and allow democracy to kind of, flourish there, or at least if by democracy we mean the will of the sort of population. Mm-hmm. So I remain very skeptical of the theater that we watch and the rhetoric that we're hearing, because I just don't see the Pentagon or the U.S. policy establishment writ large really kind of reconsidering its policy of supporting autocracy over democracy in Egypt.
And yet, haven't we been promoting democracy? Doesn't that fly in the face of what we have at least been talking about, Professor Gabashi?
Well, I share the skepticism. Critics of U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East and Egypt in particular have always noted that there's a discrepancy between U.S. support for democracy rhetorically, and even materially. The U.S. does fund lots of non-governmental organizations, particularly in the fields of human rights and democracy development, or what they call capacity building, women's rights, microloans, etc. That all exists, but the real levers of power are, as Professor Stacker just pointed out, general-to-general contact between the Pentagon and the high-ranking members of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in Egypt. I think that the U.S. would like stability in Egypt to be reestablished on new foundations where you do have elected institutions, but that those elected institutions have no sway over key items of policy. These are foreign policy, aspects of domestic economic policy that would keep Egypt's main structures of economic privilege intact, and also domestic security sector. Police reform. This is one of the main headline demands of the revolutionaries in Tahrir, and already the new president-elect has shown that he would probably be very conciliatory towards the Egyptian police forces. Yesterday he met with the chief of police, the interior minister, to reassure him, essentially, that there would be no purge of the security sector. So I think that U.S. policy is facing a critical juncture, but I think the forces of stability within the U.S. administration are going to yet again win out over those diplomats and other U.S. officials who would like to see the democratic process really take its full sway.
Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I believe that any form of government, I mean, the best that the United States, I'm speaking as a small L liberal, the best thing that can happen is that some kind of bottom-up, you know, of by and for the people kind of democracy arises in Egypt. But I think it's unrealistic to expect that that's going to conform to Western notions of pluralism and protection of minority rights, women's rights, etc. I just don't think that's realistic based on the culture and history of the period of the region. But the notion of the top down form of authoritarianism is, and the fact that we feel we have to, we can best do business with those kinds of governments, is one of the reasons that fuels so much anti-American feeling over there. Is the fact that one of your guests used the rhetoric, he said, who lost Egypt? You know, the idea that Egypt was ours to lose in the first place is, I'm sure that if you went to an average Egyptian, they would just, that would just chafe them to hear that kind of, that rhetoric used at all.
Professor Stacker.
Absolutely. The thinking in Washington and inside the Beltway is incredibly patrimonial, not only to Egypt, but most developing countries in the world. Egypt, of course, has a strategic relationship with the United States since the 1970s and the signing of the Camp David Accords. The United States has always treated Egypt as a sort of client state and something to be managed or to deliver services or provide some sort of service to, service American, empire in the Middle East. And so, I totally, respect what you're saying. And I do think that, this is one of the real sources of anti-Americanism in the region, because it has nothing to do with, our culture or American culture as much as it has to do with, the way we structure our politics and interact with them. And the last thing I'd like to quickly just say is that, I don't know that Egyptians have been given a fair chance to actually sit down and actually pursue a genuine political transition, where all the sort of civilian parties can sort of interact and converse and, share ideas and argue and figure it out. Egyptians can definitely figure out a sort of democratic bottom-up transition. The problem is they haven't been allowed to do that because, SCAF keeps intervening in ways that create realities that, preclude or exclude some potential contributors from actually even getting to the table to discuss the transition. So, and that the reason why this transition gets discussed as messy or mismanaged, it has nothing to do with the people that were pushing for greater, political change. It's has everything to do with the way that SCAF has precluded certain options from being available.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the future of Egypt this hour of the program. We have two guests, Mona El-Ghabashi, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Barnard College and Columbia University, and Professor Joshua Stacker, assistant professor of political science at Kent State University, author of Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you'd like, talk@WPR.org, or go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and leave a message on Facebook. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Wednesday, We'll be talking about the latest environmental news, and it's not good news. Wildfires, horrendous wildfires in the west, terrible flooding in the north and the south, and a new report showing sea levels are rising significantly on the east coast. So that's coming up, hour number two. Egypt this hour, 800-486-8655 is our number, and it's talk at WPR.org. We go to Mike in Whitefish Bay next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm pretty embarrassed about being ignorant and naive about Egypt, but is Egypt essentially Cairo, or is the population dispersed, the effective population dispersed over the rest of the country? And then also, what language do they speak there? And the third thing I'd like to know is there a Christian element of any significance in Egypt? I understand there's a population segment called the Coptics, but I don't know if they are a feckless, ineffective minority.
All right, thank you.
There is a Christian population. It's Coptic Christian. It's about tantamount to about 10 to 12% of the population, although the numbers aren't form. What they are is a sort of offshoot of Greek Orthodox. So in this respect, you would just call them Egyptian Orthodox. They have their own church, their own papal system and whatnot. In terms of language, they speak Arabic with a sort of distinct Egyptian colloquial tinge to it that is recognizable throughout the Arab world. And I would argue that Egypt is not just Cairo. Cairo and Alexandria are the two largest cities in Egypt. But I would say that more than half of the population does not live in an urban area. And I know that just from sort of casually watching sort of Egyptian elections over the years, the more interesting parts of Egyptian elections always happen away from the city centers, because that's where the sort of real bread and butter issues are being distributed as well as sort of negotiated. And so there is a danger to being very Cairo-centric when we analyze Egyptian politics.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the economy in Egypt. We have heard reports that tourism has been down, that there are a lot of people who run trips to various locations and they're hurting. How is the economy? And I know the military is tied into the economy as in some substantial ways. If you can talk about that, Professor Al-Ghabashi.
The economy in Egypt has indeed witnessed a downturn, although just recently the news showed that the stock market on the day after the presidential election 2 days ago saw its largest surge in many years. Part of the military's role in politics is cemented through its role in the economy. It doesn't just control military-industrial complexes, but over the past 20 years, it's also branched out into parts of the civilian consumer economy. So they run supermarkets, they run bottled water companies, they run social clubs that are open to fees-paying members. And so the reason why they're so keen to remain at the center of the political system is to protect these economic privileges that flow right into the coffers of the top generals and also their dependents.
And how long has that been going on, that they've owned and been involved in all of those organizations and all those parts of the economy? And is that an unusual thing?
I mean, it started during the time of Abdel Nasser and experienced a tremendous expansion during Sadat's presidency as he cut them out of sort of formally participating in politics. I think that, the point with the economy is that, while they've got these sort of, tentacles in virtually everything, this is one of the areas that makes them so difficult, is because they receive so much transnational sort of support from places like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Emirates, the United States, Europe, right? Because when these, groups show up and they want to invest their money, what they're looking for is they're looking for a guaranteed market where there's very little competition. And because the military has monopolistic interests in various sectors like shipping and parts of tourism and sort of areas of the country that are the largest land owner. I mean, the military essentially becomes the safest place to invest your money. And so the transnational connections to this actually help perpetuate this system of military sort of dominance in the economy, which then, of course, has domestic repercussions that make them very difficult to remove.
Hmm. We go to Danny in Green Bay next. Hi, Danny.
Hello. Just got one comment, and I'll take my comment off the air. I do know that Egypt's history has been a very progressive one when you look at women's rights and how they, along with Turkey, have sort of been more of the shining lights of progressiveness in the Middle East. It seems that we're lacking any foresight of that in our foreign policy, and it's troubling that we think that militarily we can continue to succeed where historically not much has in the way of foreign intervention in Egypt.
Professor Al-Ghabashi.
Well, that's true. Egypt is a bellwether in the region. It's often the place where things happen first, and then they percolate towards the rest of the region, although that sometimes can be overstated. There's a very old feminist movement in the country that continues to this day. There's also, I want to pick up on an earlier caller, what he talked about minorities and the role of minorities in Egyptian politics. This is very significant right now as the new president is starting to make overtures to reassure the fears of both women and minorities. And there are recent reports circulating in reputable newspapers that suggest that Morsi may appoint two vice presidents, one a woman and one a Coptic Christian. Of course, this would be a signal to these groups not to fear the Muslim Brothers, and this may be also a strategy by the new president to try to rally around him as many civilian forces as possible as some sort of a counterweight to then negotiating and bargaining with the ruling military general.
And let's talk about, for just a little while here, the Muslim Brotherhood. There are people who fear the Muslim Brotherhood, who think that it's a very narrow organization, very anti-Israeli organization. BJ on Facebook writes, the Muslim Brotherhood has been around since 28. It was formed to oppose British occupation of Egypt and presumably should not be confused with modern-day terrorist groups. Give us a better understanding of it. Whoever would like to start. Professor Stacker?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so, the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that's been around for 84 years. And it's a very big tent organization in the sense that, it welcomes sort of all comers. And over the course of years and the various contexts that the Egyptian Muslim Brothers have found themselves in, I mean, they've been the object of intense political repression and torture. And so they have had a lot of people, usually what people do is they finger Sayyid Qutb and say that, he's the sort of father of sort of modern jihad or extremism, and he was the Muslim Brotherhood, therefore the Muslim Brotherhood represents this.
Mm-hmm.
But, on the other side of that, I mean, they've had a lot of, pragmatic thinkers and progressive thinkers, and, if we look at the organization's actions since, they were reintegrated in the politics under Sadat, what they've done is they've not used violence ever. They've participated in elections from anything from, the local guilds and syndicates all the way up to sort of the presidency. They are a real force for sort of, guiding politics in what we would consider very sort of routine and predictable ways. Certainly, it's a complicated group. There's a lot of different people in it. I'm sure we can find people in there with sort of despicable sort of ideas about the world. But, overall, the norm of that group is very much a center pragmatist and sort of participatory in all sorts of elections. So, I don't think that we should fear the Muslim Brotherhood at any respect. But, that question is also complicated because what it does is it assumes that the Muslim Brotherhood are sort of ultimate agents of free will. Like, they're going to have the ability to kind of do and implement whatever they want, whenever they want. And that's just not the reality, given the, constructural constraints put on them by the SCAF,
by the protest movement, by, you know, minority and labor sectors, by the international community. So, you know, I don't think, and all signs are that the Muslim Brotherhood right now is reaching out to as many groups as possible to build consensus. You know, and there's people that are sort of bad-mouthing them whenever they do something, but they're making it seems like an honest effort at this point.
Professor Gobashi, about 30 seconds.
I would just echo what Professor Stacker said. The best way to think about the Muslim Brothers is a conservative political party, a large tent organization that has different trends within it. And right now it's very important to watch how they're going to maneuver their new power struggle with the armed generals, whether they're going to reach out to members of the population to try to build a coalition, or whether they're going to enter into a deal with the generals once again.
Well, you've got a lot of fascinating work ahead of you, both of you. It couldn't be a more interesting time to be doing the jobs that you're doing, could it?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much. You were both so informative, and thank you. Our guest this hour, Professor Mona El-Gobashi, Assistant Professor, Department of Political Science at Barnard College, and frequently goes to Egypt. She just returned from looking at the elections, as did Professor Joshua Stacker, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Kent State University and author of a number of publications, including Adaptable Autocrats, Regime Power in Egypt and Syria. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for securing these excellent guests. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for doing our production on air here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up in a moment and then another interesting hour. Well, many interesting hours will follow, so stay with us.